It's Ideasphere with Dr. Sigrid Fry Revere, the kidney sellers.
We've been concentrating so hard on the high-tech cadaver organ route that we've really neglected the fact that the living donor route is cheaper and easier. It's also not high-tech.
America has a shortage of organs for transplant. Iran has an abundance. That's the reason many wealthy Americans turn to Iran for help when they're stuck on a waiting list. Hello, I'm Guy Rothbun. Welcome to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices. My guest is Dr. Sigrid Fry Revere, author of the book, The Kidney Sellers. She's the founder and president of the Center for Ethical Solutions and a member of the Washington, D.C. Regional Transplant Communities Organ and Tissue Advisory Committee. Dr. Fry Revere, thank you so much for taking this time.
Well, thank you.
I want to open our discussion with your trek across Iran that took time, not to mention risk, for your research. During that period, you were going on a hunch. Rumor had it that the Iranians had a much better system for organ donations than anywhere else besides Spain.
Well, actually, the difference is between deceased organ donation and living organ donation. And Iran had essentially solved its kidney shortage through working for 30 years to perfect its living donation program. Spain and the rest of the world has been focusing on deceased organ donation. So, you know, when you sign your card. And the reason Iran can get close to solving its organ shortage with living donors is because 90% of everyone out there who's on the waiting list, which in this country is over 100,000 people, need kidneys. And for kidneys, a living donor is actually better. You know, if you have a heart or a lung or intestines that you need, which is the other 10-15% of people on the waiting list, then you have to get it from a deceased donor. But for kidneys, you don't.
Some are going to perk up on this and say, this is rather macabre. It's something I don't really think we should be talking about. And there are medical ethics involved.
Absolutely, there's medical ethics involved. The issue is, in this country, for the past 30 years, one-third of our kidneys have come from living donors. The difference is we do not allow any benefits to go to those donors other than mostly medical expenses and occasionally travel and lodging. In some places, they can get paid leave off of work if they're government workers, or if their recipient is rich enough, they can give them lost wages. But for the most part, it's not macabre because we're encouraging people to do it all the time. It's just for most people, it's too expensive to donate. There's a recent study done by Zip Codes that shows poor people are far less likely to do a living donation than rich people. And that as the economy has gone down in the last 10 years, rich people's rate of organ donation has stayed the same, but the poor people's rate has gone down because as we've become economically insecure, the idea of spending $10,000 or $20,000 to help a friend or a relative becomes impossible.
Sure.
When you're financially insecure.
Something that Iran is doing that the U.S. has toyed with the idea of, but again, we'll touch upon this ethical side, is the concept of actually compensating people for the donation.
That's right. Iran actually started 30 years ago with a free market in organs, and their courts would enforce the contracts and everything. And they closed it because so many foreigners were coming there, including Americans, and buying kidneys, and they were outbidding the local people who needed kidneys. So they closed the market and started regulating it. And it's really interesting because what fascinated me more than anything else when I was over there is that there is quite a bit of difference from one region to the other as to how they've implemented the laws. And, you know, a lot of the research we have and articles from Iran are 20 years old, and the system has changed so much since then because it's been constantly evolving, you know, evolving with new regulations and new benefits and requirements and things like that. And the package that donors get now is pretty extensive. Health insurance for them and their families, dental care, eye care, job services, small business loans. It's not just money. It's seen as a social service, and it's done through nonprofits run by volunteers. So there's no organ brokers. So when we think of selling, we think of the black market, you know, where there's an organ broker that takes 90% of the money and gives the poor schmuck who's willing to sell the organ because they're so poor $1,000, you know. But that's not what's happening. I mean, these Iranians are getting anywhere from 1.5 to 3 times the average individual income in Iran. They're getting a lot.
Isn't there a much larger chance of exploitation, though?
Well, that's the whole issue. That's what's so fascinating. Are you being exploited if it's regulated and there's informed consent? And are people tempted by the money? Yes. But if you're poor, what's better, to go work in a coal mine for 3 years or to save a life? That's the thing that just blows my mind, that people don't understand that if it's the black market, you have people being swindled and cheated. And, you know, in India, you have people stealing organs and people not getting the money they're promised. But in Iran, the money is put in escrow. The social services are available through nonprofits that are available to everyone. And it's mostly middle class people who both donate and receive organs. And they use it to do things like pay for education, start a business, build an addition on their house, buy a car to start a taxi service. Of course, also get out of debt. But if you think about it, the way Iran has looked at it is you have two people who need something, right? You have one person who needs money to make their life better and another person who needs a kidney to survive. That as long as they're fair and there's informed consent and the government makes sure no one's cheating anyone, it's a win-win. And since it's the only place in the world where it's legal and very heavily regulated, actually, there is very little that I saw that I found offensive. I mean, I found some things in some of the poorer areas. I think there were problems simply because Iran is a developing country and they didn't have the medical facilities that I felt were appropriate. But that's different from the system itself. There were two regions, particularly Isfahan and Mashhad, where there were, instead of transplant waiting lists, there were waiting lists of people who wanted to donate.
Just the reverse of what we experience in the U.S.
Oh, we have 30 people dying every day. Every day. Between 20 and 30 people, depending how you count it. And there, if you need a kidney, you get one. If you're medically qualified, you get one. And it's much cheaper to maintain someone on a transplant than on dialysis. And it's a much better quality of life, too. It's just that we have always been very technologically minded. And so we thought, cadavers? Limitless source. But the truth is, fewer than 1% of the population die under conditions where you can harvest the organs or retrieve the organs for transplant. I mean, I'm on the ethicist for the Washington Regional Transplant Community, mm-hmm, for their Organ and Tissue Advisory Committee. And they fight over kidneys from people with cancer or people who are 90 years old or people who've had strokes. So they're putting sub-quality organs in people because they're so desperate for them. If Iran can find an ethical way to do living donation without it being totally free, and by totally free, that's really a misnomer, because the poor donors, we've reserved free, in air quotes, free organs for the rich, because essentially only the rich have friends who can afford to donate. I tried to be a donor and got disqualified essentially for not having enough money. It was unbelievable. And I'm a middle-class person. It just blew my mind that in order to help my friend, I would have to spend 3 months of doing testing and being at the hospital and recovering and everything, and use $20,000 of my own money. I had 3 kids in college. Where was I going to get that? And so it made me think, what about all the other people? If you're a living donor, you're already giving so much. Should you also be expected to use your own money to save another person's life? In the least, you know, it's one thing you think it's unethical to tempt people with money. It's another thing if you want to make sure that all their needs are covered so they don't end up financially worse off for the donation. Those are really two different ethical issues.
Sure.
Right now, I'm actually lobbying in Congress to try to eliminate the financial disincentives for donation. You know, I want to allow private charities, donors, recipients, and government to step in when donors don't have enough money to donate. So they don't have to make the choice between taking care of their family financially and saving someone's life.
In case you're just tuning in, talking with Dr. Sigrid Fry Revere, author of the book, The Kidney Sellers. Do you have a website, blog, or anything you'd like to share?
Yeah, right now, I actually, because of the book, a DC law firm helped me start Stop Organ Trafficking Now. And so stoporgantraffickingnow.org is the website where there's a petition people can sign if they're interested, that just says what we want to do is get Congress to think seriously about helping donors donate. So that's stoporgantraffickingnow.org. And the reason it has that title is because Americans are among the worst offenders on the black market because we're a rich country. And so we're the ones that go and violate poor people abroad because someone who's desperate and afraid of dying who has money will do desperate things. And unfortunately, there are people in developing countries that get hurt. So if we make it easier for Americans to help Americans, then there'll be less exploitation.
Hence your think tank that you formed quite a while back now, the Center for Ethical Solutions.
Correct. That was even before I went to Iran, and we had a Solving the Organ Shortage project. And one of the things we did was try to gather data about how organ donation was done around the world. And you're right, Spain has done a good job, but what Spain has managed to do is keep its list from growing, which is a very different thing than eliminating the list, which Iran has done in a couple of its cities.
This is going to perk up a number of ears. When I ran across it, I thought, well, of course, this is logical. When you use Dr. Jacob's calculation, he says that for every 1,000 used to purchase a kidney, 15,000 or more would be saved in dialysis costs.
That is a very excellent point, but I think, you know, from an ethical standpoint, I think it's beside the point.
Sure.
Because I think we have to be very careful that if we end up going the route of compensating donors, we need to make sure that we take good care of those people. You know, that they have health insurance, like they've done in Iran, that it becomes almost a social welfare program where people can take advantage of a variety of benefits that they need to improve their lives. I mean, they have saved somebody's life. You can't just throw that person away and treat them like a commodity or something. I think we owe them a lot, you know, like firefighters or someone in the military. I mean, that's a bad example right now, isn't it? With everything going on with the VA, but
yes.
Someone helps save another person's life, you're supposed to take care of that person. So we have to make sure these people have life insurance, whatever social services they need to improve their life, as well as enough money to cover their costs. Now, that being said, the new data is even more remarkable. There are some estimates out there that by coming off dialysis, you're saving Medicare up to $200,000 a year per patient. So that's a lot of money.
I think a lot of folks would recognize the value of this.
Yeah. And when we go lobby in Congress, I'll be going again on Friday. There are a lot of people. The debate in the last 30 years in this country has been no money or incentives. The idea of taking care of donors' costs as a compromise way, an ethical way to deal with the problem and increase the number of people who can donate, hasn't really been talked about much. And so they're like, okay, wait a minute, which camp are you in? And when I say neither, they look at me like, what are you talking about? I don't understand. You want to pay donors? That's bad. And I say, no, not if you're just helping them donate by making sure they can pay the babysitter and their travel costs and their lost income or sick leave or whatever it is that they have to sacrifice to donate other than their organ. As long as we find a way that they suffer as little as possible financially. takes a little bit of explaining to help people understand how that's not unethical, more or less to keep the donor whole other than the organ that's been donated, so that we don't punish them for their altruism.
You know, you bring up a very interesting subject here. You mentioned the VA, and I was going to ask this anyhow. Are you getting backlash from your proposal from those who are saying another government program regulated by this government that can't handle the Veterans Administration or Obamacare?
Well, the thing is, kidney transplants and dialysis is a program that Medicare already covers 100%. It's not based on how old you are like Medicare or how poor you are like Medicaid. If you have chronic kidney disease and you don't have insurance, it doesn't matter. You automatically get covered by the government. So it already is a 100% government program. So it really is a question of how we make that program more effective rather than building in anything new.
What has been the biggest hurdle that you have to overcome as far as convincing Congress or others to back you in this effort?
The fact that it's a new idea. I was so excited when that study came out just a couple days ago based on zip codes, because people would say, you know, how do you know poor people can't afford to donate? And I said, if I'm middle class and I couldn't afford to donate, there must be other people out there. And now there's some data showing up that I'm right. So the fact that people haven't thought of this as a problem and just now are starting to think of it, now we're getting more data and more articles and more stories in the news, and that makes them feel more comfortable with the idea. So one study in Canada at one hospital, 24% of the people they interviewed who were family members who'd been asked to donate who said no, said they didn't because of financial concerns. Now, that's a lot of people saying no to saving their relatives because they can't handle it financially. Being off work that long, losing that much disability, being away from their kids, whatever. In this country, it tends to be the wealthy, or occasionally you have a young college student who doesn't have a lot of responsibilities or a lot of financial obligations, who can take 2 or 3 months off to do all this in the summer or whatever. But the average American who has a family or job responsibilities, it's very hard for them to do it.
The book is The Kidney Sellers, Dr. Sigrid Fry Revere. There are plenty of websites to check out. First, stoporgantraffickingnow.org. There's also the ethical-solutions.org and beadonor.org. This is Ideasphere. I'm Guy Rothbun. We'll be right back. We're back with Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices. I'm Guy Rothbun with guest author Julia Shopik, Honest Medicine, Effective, Time-Tested, Inexpensive Treatments for Life-Threatening Diseases. One of the treatments that really caught my attention, it had been used since the 1920s, and it's a diet.
Yep.
And yet it was overlooked, even though the Mayo Clinic and John Hopkins were using it extensively in the 1920s and 30s, it was decided later that we'd be better off with pharmaceuticals.
Well, that's an interesting story, too. You're talking here about the ketogenic diet, which
yes.
is a very high-fat, low-protein, low-carb diet that, for some reason, mimics fasting. And even in the Bible, Jesus was asked how he stopped a man's seizures, and he says with prayer and fasting. The ketogenic diet was the standard of care in the 1920s on at both Hopkins and at Mayo Clinic. And then in the 40s, anti-seizure medications came on the market. And guess what? The diet didn't stop, but it almost stopped. One of the heroes of my book, of Honest Medicine, usually they're physicians, right? The heroes, the doctor stepped outside the box, like Dr. Berkson and Dr. Bahari, whom we'll talk about later. But this person, I decided, there was a doctor who died recently, Dr. John Freeman, who championed the diet. But I am convinced that it was a layman, Jim Abrams, a Hollywood producer, director, writer of the movie Airplane, you know, that's
yes.
My hero for the ketogenic diet and the hero of many.
Yes, the Charlie Foundation is his work now.
Exactly, because in 1994, Jim's infant son, Charlie, developed what we call intractable seizures. These are seizures that won't quit. One seizure ends, a new one begins. Another one begins. At one point, little Charlie, 1 year old, was getting 100 seizures a day. And the way Jim puts it, our house was full of tears. Our home was full of tears. And Jim, being the Hollywood, you know, big shot, was able to afford the best of the best of the best.
Sure.
You know, he was able to go to the best places, to travel to the best places, to find the best doctors. One after another, put little Charlie on anti-seizure medications. And at one point, Charlie was on, I believe it was 4 or 5 at the same time. And there is a link in my book, In Honest Medicine, to a video where you can see little Charlie with a harness on his back because he was bumping into walls, literally was, and had to be harnessed in because he was so drugged. And Jim went to the library one day. Remember, this was before the internet. And he decided to do research, not to find another treatment. He wasn't that sophisticated yet. He was just looking to find some way that his family was going to survive living with a child who just wasn't going to get better. The intro to Jim's contribution is a quote from a doctor that basically said, you know, this kid has no hope. All we could do is to keep drugging him or to do a surgery on his brain. No hope at all. And so Jim went to the library. What does he find? He finds a diet that you mentioned before, the ketogenic diet that's been around since the 20s. So he got excited. There were small studies done from the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, all the way through the 90s. They were about how the ketogenic diet stopped seizures in children. And he brought them to the doctor. And his doctors all said, don't do it, it won't work. And Jim says, to my everlasting shame, I listened to them one last time, and I allowed them to do a surgery on my baby's brain. They did the surgery. He said, there's nothing more pathetic than watching your little baby. He says it was like a lump on the bed as they were carrying him in. And he said he came out of the surgery, he had more seizures, and at that point, Jim said, enough. You know, he finally got the message. And he and his wife, Nancy, took little Charlie to Johns Hopkins, where they administered the diet. 48 hours later, his seizures stopped. And Jim was so excited at first, and then he got furious. He said, why didn't I know? Why did they discourage me? Not only did they not tell me, but when I found it, they discouraged me. And then, light bulb time, why aren't other people being told about it? And he went on a mission. The first thing he did was to put out an instructional video about the ketogenic diet. He got his good friend Meryl Streep to do the video. And one of the staff that was hired to do the video was also working on Dateline NBC. So this is one cool story. So he called his bosses up at Dateline NBC, and Dateline NBC said, this sounds like a wonderful story, you know, how a diet cured seizures in a little baby, about 1 year old at this point. And they said, let's do a story on Dateline NBC. Well, they did. They did a two-part story, and I have linked to it in Honest Medicine in my book. And then all heck broke loose, and Jim got stories and letters, how do I get the diet? What am I going to do? My story is just like your story. They're drugging my child. And Jim started the Charlie Foundation, C-H-A-R-L-I-E, foundation.org. And his mission became to educate people about the diet, and also not only to educate them, but don't forget, remember I told you that the diet had all but fallen out of favor? He had to get other staff in other hospitals around the world educated about it in order for people to get the diet. So he hired a dietitian named Beth Zupik-Kenya, who contributed some information to my book, and Beth came on board with him. By the way, I do want to mention the dietitian at Johns Hopkins, Millie Kelly. She also contributed to my book. Both of them have a mission to get the word out about the diet, but she's no longer working at Johns Hopkins. But Beth Zupik-Kenya and Jim are spreading the word, and Jim says, now I can go to sleep. There are over 100 hospitals worldwide and growing every day that have ketogenic diet programs. I should say that anyone listening who says, oh, my kid has seizures, I'm going to put him on a low-carb, high-fat diet, don't do it. It needs to be started in a hospital. It needs to be calibrated by professionals, because each child's diet will be a little bit different from another child's, just variations. And it's very serious. One of the stories that is told, contributed to Honest Medicine, is by Jean McCauley. And she tells how when the diet was administered incorrectly, her child had terrible side effects, went into almost a coma. So it needs to be started in the hospital, but Jim is making sure that hospitals are knowing how to do it. And it's a wonderful story.
Honest Medicine is the book. It's unfortunate we don't have more time here because there are so many stories. Is there one in particular we can wrap
this
up
with? Yes, I'd like to wrap it up with the low-dose naltrexone. This is a wonderful treatment, low-dose naltrexone. It's a treatment that works for many people with all sorts of autoimmune diseases. The people that got on board first were people with multiple sclerosis, people with lupus, people with rheumatoid arthritis, people with fibromyalgia. But literally, it was started because Dr. Bernard Bahari was working with drug addicts in the 1970s and 80s in New York City. And he was a big shot in New York City government working with drug addicts. And in 1984, naltrexone was FDA approved for drug addicts. And it was approved at very high doses. And at very high doses, it was toxic. If people took the high dose naltrexone in the morning, that if they then went and took heroin, the heroin would not make them high. So it was supposed to discourage them. But Dr. Bahari found that when he gave it in these high doses, it made people crazy. He said, but he noticed that it had a wonderful effect on the immune system. He was a curious doctor, unlike so many doctors today. He said, how low can I give this drug to make it so that it has endorphin-raising capabilities? By the way, in so doing, makes the immune system work better and also will work on the immune system without the side effects. And he found that he could go as low as 3 milligrams and it would have wonderful effects. A lot of his drug addicts had HIV/AIDS, and he found that when he gave it in low doses, the HIV/AIDS stopped progressing. Word got around. He began to give it to people with MS, with lupus, with all the conditions I described, and more asthma, Hashimoto's thyroid disease, all of these. And they were doing very, very well. In some cases, it actually reversed the disease. It didn't do that with MS. For some reason, it just stops the progression. It can't really undo the harm to the myelin sheath that MS does. But in some cases, it actually reverses it. There are cases of Parkinson's where people have almost had a reversal of all of their symptoms with low-dose naltrexone. And it's made by compounding pharmacies. It's dirt cheap. I mean, it's like $20 to $30 a month. And this low-dose naltrexone, its only symptom that people have noticed, a side effect, is vivid dreams. So I'm on a mission to also, like Jim Abrams with his ketogenic diet, to get the word out about this inexpensive drug. People are suffering. They're suffering with the autoimmune diseases, and they're suffering with the treatments that are being given for them. And this is important. Our healthcare system or disease treatment system is going broke, paying for treatments like Remicade. These are very expensive treatments. As a matter of fact, some treatments for multiple sclerosis, there's one that is, I believe it's called Galenia, and it's $60,000 per patient per year. And LDN, low-dose naltrexone, is about $500 per patient per year. Quite a bit of difference.
Julia Shopik, thank you so much for this.
Thank you so much. I'm writing a book now, by the way, Guy, totally about low-dose naltrexone.
That's terrific. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me on.
Absolutely.
Bye-bye.
Bye. My guest has been Julia Shopik, author of Honest Medicine. You can see more of her work at honestmedicine.com and check out our Facebook page as well. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, write to me at rathbunproductions@gmail.com. This program is a distribution of Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. For Ideasphere, I'm Guy Rathbun.